Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Gina Barreca is a professor at the University of Connecticut and a feminist scholar. She's written several books and has many other columns published all over the place. She's very funny and fun to read. Her latest book, It's Not That I'm Bitter, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying About Visible Panty Lines and Conquered the World, is now out in paperback. Gina joins us today. Welcome to the show, Gina.
I'm so glad to be here, Ann.
I read several reviews of It's Not That I'm Bitter, and they mostly were positive. One reviewer, however, although she loved your humor, was disappointed that you did not equip her to conquer the world.
Well, you know, she's got to read the rest of the books. What can I tell you? You can't do it all in one book. It's not so much a how-to book as it is a where we've come from and where we're going book. Although, you know, I think that if we're going to conquer the world, and this works for men as well, the one thing that you need to do is to be able to laugh every day. And I'm fortunate enough, I do a lot of writing, as you said, and I'm also, I go and speak at conferences all over the place. And the one thing that always amazes me is how many people come up and say, I haven't laughed that hard in so long. And I think we need to make sure we do that. Always, because life is a riot. You have two ways of going through life. You can either gnash your teeth and rent your garments, and, you know, rent is really hard to come by these days, or you can laugh at it and then do something about it. Because you laugh at it doesn't mean you're giving up on it. You can laugh at it and redouble your effort.
When you're writing, Gina, well, after you've written something and it's funny, do you go back? Does it make you laugh?
Well, it depends. Usually that's a really good question. Usually it takes some time. You know, it takes a couple of months to get some perspective on it because usually I remember, you know, having to craft something. I mean, that's the thing about humor. Some of it just comes out, you know, quickly. And often those are simply the things that I write down. A lot of humor, I find, is just the stuff that you overhear.
Yeah.
It's just stuff that you can't believe that somebody said, or it's the absurdity of paying attention to something that's in an ad or just the way something is, you know, is just out there. And then if you just write it down, you don't need to even embellish it at all. You don't need to make something up. When I give advice to people about writing humor, I say just make sure, you know, you carry a post-it note with you.
Mm-hmm.
You just something where you just write down what somebody says. And you can make yourself laugh at the end of the day, you know, constantly just by paying attention.
Is there somebody you trust especially to make sure that what you write is funny and isn't just, you know, you haven't internalized it too much?
Actually, no.
I'm asking all these questions because I'm a terrible humor writer and I envy you horribly.
Oh, I don't believe that for a minute. But I really do think, if anything, one thing I've learned, because I have, you know, I teach creative writing classes at UConn where I've been teaching for 23 years. I'm a professor. And my students will come up and say, well, you know, I took this to my writing group and I read this to my mom and I took this. And sometimes it's like you end up making, you know, bologna out of, you know, some fabulous meal that you started out with, but you process it so much that it ends up not being anything, where it started out wonderfully. But if you overdo it, I'm not a great believer in taking everything that you write to have somebody go over it. I think that often humor needs to come out as fresh as possible. It's like, you know, organic products or something. You need to get it right off the farm. You need to keep it as clean as possible, as opposed to having a lot of people write it, read it. I know, for example, because I write for psychology, I blog for Psychology Today and for the Chronicle of Higher Education. And those I have to do, you know, a couple of times a week. So I'm always writing for those places. So I know that some will be better than others. And believe me, the readers let me know when something works and something doesn't. And it is, you know, some readers will love a piece and others will hate it. Some people think I should be stoned in the street.
Well, I know that feeling,
like me. Yeah, buried up to the neck and then, you know, the horse.
The army ants.
Yeah, right, exactly. And that's, they think that would be too good for me. And then there are other people who are saying, I'm cutting this, you know, I'm printing this out and I'm mailing it to you. Would you sign it? Because I want to put it up on my fridge or I want to send it to my kid. So humor is also so subjective that you are literally not going to please everybody all the time. And that means, in a way, you can't get that much feedback because then it'll bleed whatever is funny out of it. And you'll end up making something incredibly bland. So I'd rather go with the deeply sort of spicy personal stuff, not spicy as in sexy, although that's nice too. But, you know, I'm 53.
But I authentic.
Mean, really,
hey,
right.
What are you knocking 53?
Yeah, 50,
I'm going there.
I always tell, you know, especially when the audience is primarily female, I said, look, the two pieces of information you really want, I'm 53 years old, I weigh 148 pounds. Now we can just deal with what I'm saying, because you know how it is. You get up in front of a room, and women especially, we want, how old is she?
Yep.
You know, and how much does she weigh? And not in a bad way. It's just like we need to know those pieces of information so that we can then just get on with it. Because the rest of the time, I would realize I'd be in front of a room of 500 women, and they'd be looking, and I would say, okay, when I graduated from high school in 1975, and women would get out, you know, their notebooks and start doing the math. And I thought I lost them while they were busy calculating 18, 75, she was born 57. And I thought it's just easier to say it. And then in terms of the size, because I've gone back and spoken to a number of groups, you know, several times, they'll have me back every couple of years, you know, women's nights or whatever. And one woman said, look, you know, have you lost weight? I can't tell. You know, you look different from the last time you were here. And she said, what size are you? And, I mean, that was a little, you know, it was interesting. And I thought, you know,
well,
what?
It depends.
I'm going to be honest. And I said, in an Armani, I'm a 12.
Right.
And if I go to dress, you know, like Dots Dress Barn Woman, I'm a 22W. Because the more you pay for the clothes, the smaller the size.
Right.
Where men don't do this.
It's no worth the money, too, isn't it?
Exactly. Well, it is. I mean, that's very... But no man would ever do this. No man would ever say, I want to be a 42 short by Christmas. Men buy clothes that fit them. We're still trying to fit into things off the rack. And that's what I mean about finding humor. It's because when you realize that, wait a minute, no man is trying to make himself fit into the clothes. You know, that's simply funny because it's the absurdity of our lives. And so there's a whole chapter on that, and it's not that I'm bitter on why we and we're the smart women, you know. I mean, you know, we're the ones who have been around since women were looking at this stuff. It's not like our grandmothers who never even talked about these things. You know, we're the ones who have been, you know, brought up with this sense of awareness, and you know, the political is the personal, and we're still trying to fit into bathing suits that are three sizes too small. So, or five sizes too big. I mean, it's one thing or the other. So, not that I'm bitter, but that's
the Now, did the not that I'm bitter phrase, because I was reading a lot of stuff, you know, that you've written before, but I didn't actually sit down and work it out. Did that come from that book and you use it a lot now, or
well,
was that something
that
you've been using?
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York.
Right.
And it's not that I'm bitter, it was simply a phrase that was used a lot because obviously it meant that people were bitter.
Right.
And there were a lot of people in Brooklyn, New York, who were bitter. And because you would say, do you see what, you know, that women feel we're too heavy if we can't fit in to, for example, the jeans we wore in high school, right? Women torture themselves about that. Men feel they're heavy if they can't fit into a foreign car. You know, there's a difference between those two things. And no one is making us do that. I mean, the media is making us do this, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, it's different. Men, you go up to a woman and, you know, you say, oh, you know, I love that jacket. She will immediately say, on sale, yeah, TJ Maxx.
That's me.
I got 20% off. And I have the card that gives me 5% back, blah, 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 blah. You go up to a man and you say, Benny, nice jacket. Where'd you get it? He says, in the closet. You know, he thinks it's a trick question. He doesn't even know what that means. Women will explain the provenance of their clothing like they're art historians. You know, men wear the same jacket they've had since 1978, even if they can't button it, you know, if they like the houndstooth. Not that I'm bitter.
Well, you know, I used to, until I had to actually throw things away, if it was a really great deal, I might save the tag and leave it in the pocket.
Uh-huh.
And every once in a while, I'd pull it out and look at it and go, yes, you know.
Hunters feel about a kill or something.
Yeah,
you know? Exactly. You like, you
yeah, it's like my
it.
Exactly.
Yeah, you want to tie it to the fender of the car and go, look what I got.
Right.
Except that my father explained to me when I was a kid, and I came back with a dress. I don't know, from Filene's basement when it still existed, some, you know, cheap dress store, And I said, Dad, look, I got a $100 dress for $20. And my father said, no, honey, what happened is that somebody else spent $100 on a $20 dress. And I thought, ooh, you know, it wasn't that I got it for cheap.
Right.
You know, nobody sells at a loss. I got it for what it was worth.
Right.
Somebody else paid more than five times what it was worth. So that was a little chastening. And it's hard, you know.
I don't know whether that makes me feel better or makes me feel worse.
Yeah, I don't know. It made me feel worse. I mean, I was like, uh-oh. I was so pleased with myself. But that was also I had a family that was deeply into humbling you if you ever felt good.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to ask you, it just cracked me up, the very short story you told at the end of one of the chapters about the headband with the flowers on it. I almost died. I just snorted. I laughed so hard. Your uncle said this?
Right. My
Tell
uncle
that story.
Said we went to Washington, D.C. We never traveled. Came from a very, not a very poor family, but a seriously working class family. And they were, my mother was a French-Canadian immigrant to Brooklyn. She married my dad and moved down from Quebec. And my father's family, my father was born in New York, but his family had come over from Sicily. And there's actually my brother and I gave a room in Ellis Island that we named dedicated to my father. Oh. So the go-between room in Ellis Island is named after Hugo Bereke Sr. And what happened was that we once as a family with my aunt and uncle went to Washington, D.C., and to dress up, I wanted to look really special. I think I was about six. You're the first person ever to ask about that.
Well, I have a headband issue.
I really know. I'm just so delighted. And there I was, and I had a pink flowered headband, and we're in Washington, and my uncle turns to my mother and says, Ann, how could you let her wear that? She looks like a farmer. And I was just so mortified. But it was like I was so pleased with myself at being in that headband, like the girly way that it was. My idea about what I looked like and apparently what I actually looked like were very far apart. And my fear is that in life that continues to happen. You know, I put on some great outfit. And, you know, it turns out that I look like Minnie Pearl,
right.
You know, and in fact, but my students have no idea who Minnie Pearl is, you know, so they just, you know, if I then say something like, oh, wow, I just caught a glimpse of myself and I look like Minnie Pearl and I see their faces and they don't know what that is. And then that makes me feel much older because then I have to explain
it just starts snowballing from there.
Right. So it's just, you know, and then I just feel I should just go home and, you know, go down into the basement and put my head in a pillowcase, you know, and that would just be better for everybody.
We have to take a short break. My guest is Gina Bereke. She's a professor at University of Connecticut. She's also author of It's Not That I'm Bitter, How I Learned to Stop Worrying About Visible Panty Lines and Conquered the World. It's in paperback now. That's what we're going to talk about. We're going to hear Gina recite some of her prose and when we return. So if you'd like to speak with her, you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We've got the Facebook page. We have Twitter. We'll give you that later. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Got dinner table discussion, water cooler chat, even pillow talk, but how often are you part of the national conversation? I'm Neil Conan. Raise your voice on everything from the news of the day to the twists and turns of culture and history on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation will be here later this afternoon from 2 until 4, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 79 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20 this morning, mostly sunny skies today and a high of 92, clear skies tonight and a low right around 70 degrees. Sunny and warm for tomorrow, a high of 93, and sunny skies for Wednesday as well, a high of 92. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. You know the email and the phone by heart. You can Twitter us at Ann Fisher, WOSU, or you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Welcome back, Gina.
Hi. Glad to be back.
You know, you mentioned that your students don't know who you're talking about, maybe, when you mentioned someone like Minnie Pearl. I do know exactly who you're talking about. But I was wondering, you know, folks have said, and I've read articles, that women's studies at universities aren't getting the student aren't as popular with students as they once were. I don't know if it's the same way at UConn, but that's – you're a feminist scholar.
Right.
What's your sense about that? Do they know what you're talking about anymore?
Well, again, a very good question. I always use, for example, I use the F word. Now, the F word in our culture, don't have your engineers get scared, is feminist. It is the word that young women are very afraid of, because they think that feminism means that they won't be able to wear earrings or dance to, you know, Shakira She-Wolf, or they won't be able to like boys, or they won't be, you know. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we know that feminism is about being able to do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. That's the idea. And, of course, I assume anybody I meet who's, like, you know, using cutlery and walking upright, if they're that evolved, I'm assuming they're a feminist, because I believe that feminism is, you know, the radical belief that women are human beings. So if we're all on the same page in terms of that, you know, women should vote. Even the really scary idea of equal pay for equal work, although, you know, some people just don't go that far, then you're a feminist. It's not, again, it's not like a tough club to get into. There's no dues. There's not a dress code. You don't have to wear shoes that go down in the back. You know, you can marry shoes, you know. I mean, it's not about what you can't do. It's about not following a script that was written 150 years ago and didn't have you in mind. And I assume that the boys I meet are feminists, because I know their moms, I know who raised them, mm-hmm. and that they should be self-sufficient human beings. And, you know, that once you understand that we're not locked into these sort of, you know, gender role stereotypes, it means you can, you know, marry and date and deal with who you want. You don't have to just be these people who, again, you're just sort of like cookie cutters that you don't have to be. But the word feminist scares my students, so that they come in at the beginning of the semester. Today is actually our first day of school at UConn. Oh. And so I'll have lots of young women, especially. I mean, you must have a lot of young women who call in, who are your listeners or who work as interns at the station. You're at OSU. And you'll notice that even the young women who are going to run NASA and who are going to be head of the, you know, National Endowment for the Arts, that young women today all speak as if they're asking questions,
uh-huh.
even when they're making declarative statements,
uh-huh.
and even the really smart ones all sound like they're morons, because in our culture, it's still considered, like, too unfeminine if you sound like you know what you're talking about. And I mean, they're not allowed to speak like that in my class. I will stop them. I mean, they come up and they introduce myself, you know, themselves to me, and they say, Dr. Bereka, you know, my name is Stephanie. And I'll go, sweetheart, don't you know? You know, are you using, like, a Discover card in another name? Is this one of those identity theft things I've heard about? It's like, do not make your voice go up if you're making a declarative statement.
Mm-hmm.
And they cannot apologize. The other thing they can't do in my class, they can't apologize before they speak. Because girls will also, again, I got a bunch of smart cookies, you mm-hmm. know? And I'll be sitting there saying, okay, so we're reading, let's say, you know, Sense and Sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm saying, okay, now, why does Marianne, who is a smart woman, but she's been reading all of these romance novels, when she falls in love, she does, why does this happen? And, you know, three hands will go up, and the young woman will say, oh, I don't know if this is true, because it really might not be what you're asking for, and I don't know if this is the correct answer, but, and then they'll come up with some really smart interpretation. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know what, you can't say that. Just answer the question. If you're going to say something stupid, own it. But I don't want to hear the apology. And sometimes they now do it to themselves silently. So I'll have a class full of people who say, okay, I'll say, what's Marianne doing? And they'll go, on page 73. And they'll have, like, said it, you know, in their heads.
Mm-hmm.
But that's better than saying it out loud. You can't apologize. You can't be this weird kind of false modesty that there it's a hangover from this idea of femininity that's no longer in play. It's like women who won't ask for raises even when they mm-hmm. deserve them, you know? That's the stuff we gotta still work on. And I'm a little surprised that after 50 years of the women's movement, we're still got to do that. But, you know, you got to do what you got to do.
Well, I would be – I had an experience when I was still in college. It was in the, I don't know, late 70s or early 80s. Mm-hmm. I dragged it out over a few years. And in a class, advertising class, taught by one of the rare female professors at Arizona State when I was there. And we were I can't even remember what we were talking about. We got on the idea of feminism and that kind of a thing. And a woman in the class raised her hand and said, you know, I didn't need all of those feminists. You know, I'm not a feminist. She goes, I did it all by myself.
Right.
And I didn't need their help. And that's when I realized, well, you know, if you don't know where you come from, then you are doomed to whatever to repeat.
Right, to repeat. Yes, absolutely. And what I say to my students, again, I don't get a commission on it if they sign up. It's not like Amway, you know. So I just tell them, that's great. You can, you know, name yourself whatever you want. That's terrific. I said, tell me when you're in the workforce for 10 years, if you don't think that there's a difference between how men and women are treated when you get to the top of your first level of work. Let's see if you think that is exactly the same. Or when you decide to take off 10 years to raise your kids and then try to re-enter the workforce, let's see what's going on, you know, with that. Let's deal with maternity leave or paternity leave. And, you know, the boys, it's as much of a straitjacket. Masculinity is as much of a straitjacket as femininity is. Mm-hmm. I mean, the boys still come in with, they feel like they have to plan out their financial lives for the next 50 years. And, I mean, that's a sin. You know, they need to have more of a sense of freedom and creativity. I raised my two stepsons that came into my life when they were 13 and 15, and they're now at that absolutely adorable, adorable age where they both finished law school. And they're so cute at this age. It's so much better than, like, the baby gap stage. Uh-huh. They're so cute when they have their own mortgages. And and, you know, so I was living in very much this all-male environment. My mother died when I was a kid. You know, I was sort of raised by my dad and my little Italian aunts. But, you know, my dad, I have an older brother. I went to Dartmouth. I was one of the first classes of women at what had been this all-male school, the last Ivy League school to go co-ed. And, you know, so it was this seriously, when I first started teaching at UConn, it was almost all men. The professorate. So it was not exactly like I've been in this all-girl environment, so don't know how men behave. It's one of the reasons that I think it's important and why I write the kind of books like I do, what goes on in Bitter, is because I think it's important for women to talk about our own experiences because they're really not what's represented. The TV programs that we see, you know, we are not the housewives of New Jersey. You know, we're really not those people, and we're not Aunt Bea from Andy Griffith anymore. You know, we're not Lucy and Ethel, although Lucy's still a great icon, you know, but we're simply not those figures. And so we need to have, you know, sort of the current versions of ourselves out there. And once we start telling those stories about our lives, first of all, that's when we do laugh out loud. But it's also when, you know, our lives are enriched because we have a sense of community that we didn't even know that we had. Actually, you asked about reading something, and as I'm just saying this, it just occurred to me that maybe there was a different part that I was read than what I had planned. Are we up to that part yet?
Sure, you can. Yeah, I'd love to hear you read something.
Okay, there's a chapter in It's Not That I'm Bitter called What I Wish I Had Known Sooner, and it's about those sort of truths of life that we're handed and that we're supposed to accept sort of without questioning. So that, you know, they're well-meant, but for example, one of them is grow where you're planted. And I thought, okay, that's really lovely, and it's supposed to be about, you know, accepting your lot in life. But I thought, you know, grow where you're planted really applies best to vegetable matter. You know, if you're an endive, it's a great piece of advice. You know, the rest of us have to get out of our little patch of dirt and shake the dust off our feet and do something, you know. And this is one of my favorites, is that, you know, the wonderful line that came out of Anita Loos's great satire, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. Mm-hmm. I wrote the introduction to the Penguin edition of that book. It's a hysterically funny book, actually. And but, you know, there's the old phrase, diamonds are a girl's best friend. And I decided that that has to be switched around. And it's your best friends who are diamonds. Okay? Mm-hmm. It's not that diamonds are your best friends, but your best friends are diamonds. It's your best friends who are supremely resilient, who are everlasting, who are made under pressure, and who are of astonishing value. And also, just as there's no such thing as fake diamonds, there are no such thing as fake friends. Either they are or they aren't. Imitations are tacky, easily spotted, and likely to fall off if you expose them to hot water. So that's one of my favorite parts of the book.
It's true.
I really like that
It's
one.
True. The girlfriend thing.
Very important. I also think there was that aphorism. Here's the end of the chapter. Finally, there's a celebrated aphorism. And in fact, one of my girlfriends had given me a sort of needlepoint version of this. Actually, I think she got it at TJ Maxx. A needlepoint version of this that I have up by my computer. And again, it's a lovely sentiment. She has it at the end of her like email signature. And it says, the best way to live is, here's the best way to live. This is on page 99. The best way to live is to, quote, work like you don't need the money, dance like nobody is watching, and love like you've never been hurt. And I write that, you know, lots of otherwise sensible individuals have gone all mushy reading those lines. Some of them have been driven to have the lines inscribed on pieces of jewelry or tattooed on their necks. But after years of reading and hearing these lines, I've decided to tell the truth. I've decided that the original version of this is wrong. There's a real error. The correct version should go as follows. So you got to listen. It should be love like you don't need the money. Work like nobody is watching, and dance like you've never been hurt. I think that much more reflects our real life.
I feel like a house of cards these days. So I completely get that.
I think love like you don't need the money, work like nobody is watching, and dance like, you know, after 50, that's a much more appropriate way of looking at the whole thing.
Unfortunately, I am now being videotaped for my second hour these days, so I can't win for losing. We have an email. It's from Ron. He says, Gina, what is it with women and compliments? Can you please give a master class that will teach my wife to take a compliment?
Oh.
It's been 27 years. Say thank you already.
Oh, please. I don't know if Ron is my best friend here, Bo, or has heard me speak before, but I have a whole routine. It is true. Women cannot take compliments. Men will take insults as compliments. and women will not take compliments. If you want to get into an argument, compliment a woman. If you say, like I said, if you go up and you say, Veronica, nice jacket,
right.
She'll explain the provenance. But if you say, I love your hair, she'll say, are you kidding? Look what they did here. Look, this whole part is uneven. She will drag you over to a mirror. Mm-hmm. She will explain to you in painstaking detail why you're wrong. It's a sin. It's a sin that women do this. Women will not accept compliments. We will argue with you. If you go up, and you know, it's one thing to do it in a relationship where it's a routine. I've been married, you know, to my husband for 19 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, we go back and forth. I know. I don't even ask him anymore, you know, how I look. One day he stopped me in my tracks. I said, how do I look? He said, compared to what? And I stopped asking.
Well, where does this come from? Is it like goes back to biblical times or something? Why is that?
I say it may be, you know, hardwired. We're looking, you know, how do I look? Because we're running away from, you know, some mastodon. I don't know. But it really is. It's the low self-esteem, you know, chant that we all have. But we want to, because we're looking for compliments. We're not allowed to ask for them. Women do not judge from within, right? We are constantly looking for affirmation from outside. But it's another one of the goals that I have when I talk to groups of women. When I say, when somebody comes up to you and says, you do a good job, because this is especially true in the workplace or in volunteerism, you know, when women, you go up and you tell a woman, that was a great job, she will tell you why it wasn't. She will say, oh, I don't get any credit for this. Marcia did this, or she'll say, if I had two more weeks, I could have done this, or, oh, you kidding, I did this all at the last minute. Now, this is part of this good girl routine that we were brought up on, where good girls are modest. Right? We're good girls, or we're self-effacing. We got to let go of that, because, in fact, part of the graciousness and a generosity in life comes from being able to say, thank you. Thank you for acknowledging this. I'm so glad that you like what I did. I'm so glad you noticed it. You know, I appreciate the recognition. And not to just say no, 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 because part of saying no, 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 you know what that does? It forces people to compliment you further. So it's this weird emotional somersault that then you get into a 20-minute argument where somebody is yelling at you to try to explain how wonderful you are. You're denying it, and everybody ends up unhappy. And that is why women, you know, no longer get compliments from men. Men say they're afraid of the sexual harassment lawsuits or something. They just don't want to stand there and argue for 20 minutes. That's what it really is. I mean, seriously.
Our own worst enemies.
Men at work say, I'm not going to compliment her because she's going to spend 20 minutes telling me why I'm wrong. Where if you go up, you know, again, to Bob and say, Bob, you look like a life raft in that jacket, he'll say, yeah, I like how the down feels, and he'll walk away. He will refuse to be insulted. And with a woman, if you say, I like you in that color purple, she'll say, really? I don't think so. I think it makes me look washed out. Don't I look a little pale? I look a little. And then you need to set fire to yourself to get away from the conversation. All you wanted to do was say, you looked nice. And by the end of it, you want to, like, you know, just, like, never talk to her again. It's not the way it should go. We need to be better about this. And this is one of the things I do. And, you know, it's not that I'm bitter. And then, you know, I wrote a book with Gene Weingarten of the Washington Post.
Right.
Who just got his second Pulitzer Prize this year. Another reason it's not that I'm bitter. Gene gets his second Pulitzer. Really, I'm not bitter at all. Not me. I would never be bitter about that. And Weingarten and I did a whole book back and forth that were a series of columns in the Post about the differences between men and women. And, you know, the first time I met him, we didn't meet at all when we did the book. We did it all by email or over the phone. And the first time I met him, I'd never seen him. First time I met him, I took him shopping because he was wearing clothes from 1971. And he had this jacket on that made him, I said, this makes you look like McGruff the crime dog. It was this, I said, I'm in New York City. I'm not going to walk with you down the street in this. I took him to Lowman's. And I said, take out your credit card. He said, this raincoat is perfectly fine. I said, not if you're going to be in my company. Take that off, like leave it in a bin on the corner so that a bum might take it. But most New York bums would say, oh, I'm not wearing that. That's from 1971. It's not even vintage, you know. So we're not even going there.
You know, really. you do that same kind of column I've seen with Larry Cohen.
With Larry Cohen,
the Hartford Current.
Every Sunday in the Hartford Current. And I don't know Larry either. I'm better doing these columns with these guys if I don't meet them.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know what it reminded me of a little bit was sort of like James Kirkpatrick and Shayna Alexander.
Right, right.
Kilpatrick.
What's her name? Right.
From 60 Minutes.
Right, that it's, I think it's also a lot like Jane Curtin. And
yeah, well, they were making fun of the 60 Minutes duo.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But I think we're more like the Jane, you ignorant, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, it's, right.
There's a certain incivility to the whole thing. It's a back and forth, and I think because I am a real girl, I think if, you know, I started going out to dinner, my husband said, why don't we meet? Apparently he has a very nice wife. He said, why don't we go out to dinner? I said, because then I won't be able to be mean.
Uh-huh.
You know, and the fun part of the column is the sort of real back and forth banter where I'm not trying to be all nice and sweet and girly, but where I can really let rip. And I think if I thought, or if I even knew, for all I know, what he's doing is putting on a persona, you know, that it's not really what he thinks. I can't believe somebody would be as ridiculous as he actually is. And so if I found that out, then again, I might be driven to be gentler and kinder. And I like, again, I can save the gentle and kind for my students and let the viciousness come out in the writing. And one of my favorite senses of accomplishment was that if you see on the paperback copy, if it's not that I'm bitter, there's a little thing on the front of the book where Dave Barry.
Yes, wrote, I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, Dave Barry wrote, Gina Borecka is very, very funny for a woman.
Right.
And I consider that a great compliment.
Because he's joking.
Because he's joking and because Dave Barry really is the funniest man ever writing, ever. And so I just thought that, you know, that was absolutely perfect. So I was absolutely delighted to get that from Dave Barry.
When we return, I want you to read that really, really funny thing about TJ Maxx.
Right.
And folks, if you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Gina Borecka, author of It's Not That I'm Bitter, How I Learned It, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying About Visible Panty Lines and Conquered the World. We'll be right back on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
developed by WOSU Public Media and the Columbus Metropolitan Library, columbusneighborhoods.org, features over 30 neighborhoods in and around Columbus and allows users to tell their own stories, post their own photos and video, and contribute to the collective story of Columbus. To be a part of this multimedia public engagement project or to learn more, visit columbusneighborhoods.org.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here, and we'll talk about ethics in everyday life with the Right Thing columnist and Emerson College professor Jeffrey Seglin. That begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.
Tomorrow night at 8 on WOSU 820, it's special coverage from NPR News as Iraq assumes its own security and the U.S. officially moves into an advisory and backup role. President Obama will address the nation. Join us for live coverage from NPR as President Obama addresses the nation Tuesday night at 8, right here on WOSU 820. 79 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high of 92. Clear skies tonight and a low of 70 degrees. Sunny tomorrow and a high of 93. All Sides continues on WOSU.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Gina Barreca. She's an English professor at the University of Connecticut. She's also an author, and we've been talking a lot about her book, It's Not That I'm Bitter. It just came out in paperback. Gina, thanks again for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Okay, read the TJ Maxx set.
Okay. Now, this is one of the inspirations for my writing the book. I actually went one April day, because, you know, they always get the bathing suits. I mean, now there are no bathing suits in stores. Now, when it's hot enough, you know, you say your weather report says it's, you know, going to be 90 degrees. Yeah. Now, when it's hot enough to get a bathing, you know, to go on the beach, we're all selling sweaters, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody's selling.
You really have to
sweaters.
Think ahead with TJ Maxx,
right? And so, you know, but this was in April, 2 Aprils ago, and so I'm going to buy bathing suits because, of course, they've just put them out, and I'm ridiculous. So, and it's April now. In April, I haven't been in the sun in months, so I'm the color of a flounder, right? It's very attractive, and I knew it was a low self-esteem day. This is on page 4. I knew it was a low self-esteem day because I'm trying on bathing suits while wearing knee-high socks. Okay? Now, the men in the audience have no idea what that means. Okay? Because no straight man in Western civilization has ever tried on a bathing suit. Men wear the bathing suits their mothers bought them when they were 17 until there's a hole where they put their keys. And then they walk into a cheap store, find a sale bin, find a bathing suit, hold it up, say, it's blue, it'll fit, and they leave. Okay? Women, but we torture ourselves. I'm not the only one. So it's a rainy day. It's maybe 50 degrees. It's as far from summer as imaginable. And yet there are all these other women around my age. And pretty much everybody is my age, I say in the book. My age is most easily defined as too old for work study and yet too young for cremation. Okay? So everybody's my age. We're huddled behind the cheap curtains, you know, in the dressing room. Mm-hmm. We've all brought in our 7 garments. We're isolated in front of the unforgiving mirrors under the fluorescent lights that give us the unflattering contours of pot cheese. And I'm hearing these noises of the kind made by victims of the Spanish Inquisition, right? So from behind the other curtains, you hear other women going, oh, oh, oh. And I have my 7 pieces too, don't forget, all of which look ridiculous even on the hanger. You know how recently the big thing was draw the eye upward? Right, that's what they kept saying in the catalogs about bathing suits. The idea was draw the eye up. So there were bells and feathers and buttons and spangles everywhere around the necklines of these bathing suits. I'm looking for a bathing suit with a live ferret on the shoulder, since that is the one thing guaranteed to draw the eye upward. And why is it that the fashion fascists tell us to draw the eye upward? Because they can't say you don't want them to look at your fat. Do can they? So we all say draw the eye upwards. That's what it means. But here was the question that came to me in a flash of insight, right, in a flash of inspiration. This is like the bulb going on over Bugs Bunny's head when he has an idea. Who's looking at women my age at the beach? Let's face it, everybody's looking at beautiful 18-year-olds. They're like gazelles. It's like watching them in their native habitat. It's like planet Earth. They're chasing frisbees and volleyballs. They're playing in the wide open spaces like Labrador puppies. So can we tell the truth here? Not that I'm bitter, but the only people looking at middle-aged women on the beach are other middle-aged women, every single one of whom is elbowing whatever poor soul she's sitting next to and saying, we're pointing, going, do I look like that one? That one. Do I look like her? Right, the one with the ferret on her shoulder? Do I look like that one? And then there's the million-dollar question, be honest. Do I look like her from the back? Right? That's what we're always asking. Do I look like her from the back? So there I am trying on an off-the-shoulder Jones of New York number with ruffles and polka dots. And I thought, Gina, if you buy this bathing suit and wear it to the beach, you can make 300 women happy instantly, profoundly, enduringly, because they would all look at themselves. And then they would look at you and go, I might not look too good, but I don't look like her. And so I bought the one piece black. I didn't buy that one. I couldn't bring myself to do it. But nevertheless, it was a moment of inspiration. I thought, I have to tell the story because everybody gets it. And I have told this. Actually, it's up on my website, which is GinaBarecca.com. I told it at the National Speakers Association in front of 1,500 people or 2,000 people. And when I said, who's looking at middle-aged women on the beach, without my expecting, the whole audience answered, middle-aged women.
Yeah.
And they yelled it back. I mean, it was just. So I thought, okay, I'm writing this book. When 1,500 people yell back, middle-aged women, you know, I mean, then you're on to something. You know, there was no memo that said this was the answer. We just all knew that was the answer. And that everybody's saying, do I look like her from the back? So it was, there is a communality of experience that you know, we need to look at. And that's funny. You know, it's not just the serious stuff. It's not just the stuff on aging and menopause and, you know, what are we going to do and drinking kobosh tea and, you know, I mean, enough with that already. We have to laugh. I mean, it's really funny. Because there are no other versions of this. Do you remember the movie Sunset Boulevard?
Mm-hmm.
The great movie with Norma Desmond.
The dripping mascara, yeah.
Right, where she's going, you know, I'm ready for my career.
See, I noticed something negative about her.
Do you know how old she is in that movie?
Oh, yeah. No, but I'm sure it's much younger than you think.
Right. She's 50.
Right. Well, you know, you mentioned Aunt B earlier, and I thought, for the love of God, Aunt B was probably in her mid 50s.
Yeah, 42 or something. Not serious. She was 42.
Yeah.
Norma Desmond was 50. I rewatched the movie, and Gloria Swanson playing her was 50.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, one of my favorite parts of the film, because it just suddenly came to me, where you've got beautiful William Holden, right, the young man. I mean, she's really the original cougar. There's a chapter in the book called Why Do You Say Cougar Like It's a Bad Thing? And so William Holden says, there's nothing wrong with being 50, Norma, not unless you're trying to act 25. And then she shoots him. It seems to me an absolutely appropriate response. I mean, it's like, and you know how old Anne Bancroft was when she was playing Mrs. Robinson?
That's how you open that chapter.
38.
Yeah, shocking. Oh, my God. You know, you think back, you think, if I only appreciated it when I was 38.
Right, and she was supposed to be the older woman.
Right.
Actually, was she 38 or 36? I mean, she was astonishingly, I'm looking it up as I'm talking, she was 36 when she played Mrs. Robinson. She was 36 years old. Dustin Hoffman was 30. There was only a six-year difference between them. But a man, you know, at 30 can still play a boy, where a woman at 36 is already playing whatever older woman she can play.
We have a call from somebody.
Oh,
I'm very interested in this call. I can't wait to hear what Jane has to say. If you'd like to give us a call, we have a few more minutes. Call 614-292-8513. And Jane, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Well, I think every parent should get her book.
Thank you.
As a child, I used to build things all the time. I was always constructing things with wood or cardboard boxes. I love cardboard. When I got in high school, I used to wander the hall and just peek in at the shop department and, oh, wouldn't that be wonderful? Of course, I could never take shop because I was a girl.
Yeah.
And so they began to say, what do you want to do? Do you want to be a nurse or a teacher? Well, I chose teaching. I went to school, became a teacher. But after 17 years, I decided I cannot do this anymore. And I went to dog grooming school. And from the very first day, and I'm trying to do one right now, holding the phone in one hand and trimming in the other. But I needed to work with my hands.
Yeah.
And that's what I love. We need to raise our children to follow their hearts, what they like to do.
Right, right. Absolutely.
So,
and also, exactly what you're doing, Jade, is another thing women do. Women do 17 things at the same time.
Oh, talk on the phone, yes.
Always. Absolutely. Yes. Men take a phone call, they sit down.
Uh-huh.
Women get a phone on the phone, it's like, okay, I can do the laundry, I can do this,
exactly.
You know, were doing, I folded my laundry this entire time we were having the conversation. I was thrilled.
Yes.
I mean, the parts I had to read, I've been sitting down, but and actually my three cats, who's your grooming, are sitting around me while we're talking.
You know, it's interesting, Jane, that when I was in college for one crazy year, I decided to be a industrial arts secondary ed teacher.
Oh.
So I was going to be the shop teacher. And my grandparents were absolutely appalled. They thought it was some reflection on my gender identification. They were very, very, very disturbed by it. And I ended up not doing it. I went into journalism, and that's what I should have done. You know, no question about it, because I couldn't get any of the projects done, but my writing, I was the best writer they'd ever had in the whole program at Michigan State. And, you know, so I didn't flunk. But we had shop in junior high, but you're right, girls in high school weren't allowed to take it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But I think that it's the same thing, and there are boys who love to sew.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you know, it's all a spectrum. Actually, in the book, and thank you, Jane, for saying that every parent should buy the book. I'm very grateful. I have a chapter in there, actually, on how no one is meaner than a 13-year-old girl. And that, I've gotten a lot of response from parents, because it's a way girls, since we're not encouraged to take out our aggressions physically, we take out our aggressions emotionally, and that could be even more damaging.
Yes.
You know, sometimes you should just let, you know, give a girl you know, a chance to run it out or do something else. I mean, she would be a lot better off if she could be on a, you know, a field kicking a ball than sniping at somebody through Facebook.
Well, even when I decided to quit teaching and go to dog grooming school, my parents were dead, but I did have a living aunt, and her comment was, "Oh, for heaven's sakes!"
Yeah.
And this was 1990.
Yeah.
1993.
So, and that's where we have to understand that we need to give credit to all of these women, including ourselves, who have branched out and made it possible for somebody to say, oh, look, you can do that too. You can be a girl and do this.
Yes.
And, you know, because without those models, it's hard to imagine.
I think it's changing. I know that girls are allowed to take shop now, and boys, I mean, I think they make boys take home ec whether they want to or not.
Right,
so. Right. But the world needs to be a cleaner place.
Yes. Thank you very much, and I can't wait to get your book.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks for the call. 614-292-8513. We have a few more minutes if you want to talk with Gina Barreca. She is the author of It's Not That I'm Bitter, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying About Visible Panty Lines and Conquered the World. Gina, you were talking about in one of the chapters, your cleaning lady, who cleaned your house.
Friend,
and it was your guilt trip column, or Why I Worry About Everything chapter.
Why women worry about everything and men nothing. But this is, a friend who allows me to keep my domestic life in place. I talk, why do I feel so guilty having another woman clean my house? And I was writing the column as Heidi was vacuuming around me and under me. And my deal is with Heidi, who I've known for 18 years. I've gone to, you know, her wedding. I've known her since she was 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So she's really like a cross between a younger sister and a daughter. And we're very much in each other's lives. And I said, Heidi, why do I feel so guilty? Now, when Heidi comes on Friday and cleans, I make myself, she's my muse, because while Heidi is cleaning, I have to write. I write for the 8 hours she's here.
Huh.
Because I feel so guilty that someone else is cleaning.
Oh.
I have to work, okay? I can't let myself do anything else. It is. I mean, Heidi is in every acknowledgement of every book I've written in the last 18 years because I write when Heidi's here. Because it's like if I have somebody else cleaning my stove and, you know, making my bed and doing the rest of this, then, you know, I'm not going to sit around and do my nails.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I better have my butt in that seat in front of the screen and doing what this time allows me to do. Because otherwise, then I should be doing. And on those days, like if it's a day that I just can't write, then I do the housework with her.
But she tells you to stop analyzing everything.
Absolutely.
And I wonder, could you do that even if you wanted to?
Well, there are the days when I'm just like I'm spent. You know, if I've just come back from a gig or something, if I've been on the road, Heidi and I will just do the stuff together. Then it'll be a big cleaning day. Then we wash the quilts. You know, turn the mattresses, we do the other stuff, then I do it with her. But I cannot just sit. I mean, I couldn't just, like, sit and read if Heidi's cleaning. That much, because I used to clean houses as a teenager. And so I know what it takes, you know. I mean, like, I know exactly. I used to clean somebody else's toilets and tubs. And so I have a very deep appreciation of exactly what it is that she's doing when she's doing it.
Right.
And so, but I'm telling you, if there are people out there, you know, especially women who'd say, gee, I'd like to write. Well, have somebody else do this stuff because you will be too ashamed not to put words on the page. You want something that's going to force
really,
you to write?
Really good point.
It really is. It is one method. And I have several friends who have followed me in this because you were too embarrassed. You'll type something because you just can't sit there because Heidi is going, you know, lift your feet. You know what I mean? You know, she's right there and she's like going at this point, she's going, I don't hear anything. You know, I mean, if I'm not at, you know, actually, you know, hearing that she can't hear the click of the key.
She'll give you a hard time.
Yeah.
Good.
I don't hear anything.
Well, our best luck. You've been listening to Gina Borrecca. She's the author of It's Not That I'm Bitter or How I Learned to Stop Worrying About Visible Panty Lines and Conquered the World. Gina, thanks for being with us. I hope you'll join us again.
Oh, I'll count on it. I love this. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. That's all the time we have. Thanks for tuning in to It's All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.